name is Carolyn. I'm an alcoholic. Guess we should take care of business first, huh? So my name is Carolyn. I am an alcoholic. My home group is the Friends of Bill W. meeting. We meet on Thursday nights at 7 o'clock at Westminster Presbyterian Church. It's an open book study. We'd love to have you join us. My sobriety date is September 11th, 2006. I have a sponsor. I work the steps out of the big book with the sponsor. My sponsor works steps out of the big book with her sponsor, who worked the steps out of the big book with her sponsor. Beyond that, I don't know. I'm supposed to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I looked something up. I want to get one more piece of housekeeping out of the way. So I like words. Sorry. It makes me nervous, just so you know. That little thing makes me nervous. I looked up the definition of God in the dictionary today, and I wrote it down. So the definition out of the dictionary is a supreme or ultimate reality or a being perfect in power, wisdom, and goodness. So when I say the word God, that's what I mean. That is the literal dictionary definition. And that can be whatever it needs to be for you. So if you want to call your God, God with a big G, or Buddha, or Yahweh, or Allah, or whatever you want to call it, doesn't make any difference to me. You know, and it talks about it in the We Agnostics. Do not let our prejudice against spiritual terms deter us from determining what they mean to us. Because that is why I'm here. Like, that's what happened to me. Is that, you know, I can tell you what it was like is it was horrible, and then I got to the point where I couldn't take it anymore, and so I came in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked the steps, and my entire life changed, because through working the steps, I developed a relationship with a higher power, whom I choose to call God. You can call whatever you want, but I'm going to forget to say the God of my understanding or a higher power, whatever, so please forgive me in advance if you don't like the term God, but we're going to go with that definition for it. So, like I said, I've been sober since 2006, and there is a story in the book, and it's called Empty on the Inside, and it's about a woman, and she writes, "I don't know where I learned the attitude that it wasn't all right not to know, but it was a certainty in my life, and it almost killed me." And I really related to that story very early in sobriety. I don't know how I got that idea in my head, but somehow as a small child, I got the idea in my head like that I had to be perfect and I had to know everything and I couldn't let you know that I didn't know. And I don't know why or where or how that came to be. You know, one of my earliest memories is my mom, I woke up in the middle of the night and my mom was like taking all the books off the bookshelf and she was throwing them at my stepdad. And I don't know why she was throwing the books at him, I can guess, but I remember I was like really upset and I was small. I was small and I was really upset. And my mom like comes and she's trying to comfort me. She's like, it's okay, he's leaving. And I'm like trying to say like, but I don't want him to leave. You know, my dad had already left. And, you know, I didn't want him to leave too. And so she then goes running outside and like stands in front of the car. So now he won't leave after she just made him leave. And, but I recall the next day feeling like I got up and I made like orange juice and toast because I was really little. And thinking like, if I can just make everything okay. If I can make everything okay, if I can make it good, if I can make it nice for everybody, then everything will be okay. And so I developed this so young, and I was never okay because I could never, ever make everything be okay. Mike had said to me earlier this week, you know, I want to hear your story from start to well, now, I guess, not finished, but till now. And the truth is that that changes because my perception just keeps changing. The longer I stay sober, the more I can see the truth and the more my perception of it changes. Because when I got here 15 years ago, I'm going to tell you something. I had the worst childhood ever. Had the worst parents. It was awful. And the truth is, I had a pretty stellar childhood. I came from a pretty good family. I never went without anything. I grew up in Pittsburgh. My parents did divorce when I was young, and there was a little bit of drama here and there. But for the most part, my life was pretty good. I do know that when I started realizing that I didn't drink like a normal person, I tried a myriad of different ways to control my drinking, and one of them was therapy, because I thought if I can figure out like what's really bothering me on the inside, then I can drink like a normal person would drink. And and that, of course, you know, didn't work. I remember I showed up at the therapist's office, and I was drunk, and you know, the therapist said, I can't help you. You know, I can't, your problem is that, you know, you're a drunk. And that's what he said exactly. You're a drunk, you know, get sober and come back and see me. But until then, there's nothing I can really do for you. But I was looking for a solution to my drinking problem that didn't actually involve not drinking, because that terrified me. And so, like I said, I grew up, what was unusual, and looking back on it now, I don't know, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg. But so I have an older brother and I have three older sisters. And my mom and dad got divorced when I was young, and my dad moved to Europe for a few years. And then when my dad came back, I was still pretty young. When he came back, he took all of my sisters and my brother to go live with him, and he left me. And so I felt like, so my mom and I lived in this small house, and my dad and the rest of my siblings lived in this really nice big house. And there was like a lot of fun over there all the time. And like, I would get to go visit, but then I would go home. And so I really developed pretty young this sense of apartness, like I didn't quite fit in and I didn't belong. And, did that cause, you know, I believe that I was born an alcoholic. I mean, that's just my personal opinion. I had all of the isms long before I picked up the first drink. And the alcohol was never the problem. The alcohol has always been my solution. I was not comfortable. I didn't know, I always felt restless on the inside. There was just something at the core of my being that was missing, and I could not figure out what it was. And when I look back, that was all the way back to being a small child, long before I picked up a drink. So that doesn't have anything to do with the booze itself. But I remember my second sponsor was telling me that she remembers like her very first drink. Like she remembers the glass and pouring it and the smelling it and tasting. And I don't remember my first drink. Like I've just been drinking so long, I don't remember. Maybe I don't know if I was too young. I don't know if I drank that memory away or what. But like in my growing up, it was kind of okay for us to have a drink now and then. It was okay for us to have wine with dinner. Like nobody cared. So it was just very normal. And so I sort of just eased into it. And you know, once I got to where I could drink a little more than just the glass of wine with dinner, that feeling of separateness, of separation, that feeling of not belonging, and that feeling of not knowing what to do went away. And I felt good. And so I drank more, and then I felt better. And so then, you know, I just kept doing that. And I kept doing it and doing it and doing it. And, well, now we're here. And so, you know, I started drinking to blackouts in high school. I was pretty young. I could drink a lot. I was pretty small. You know, I was pretty tiny and didn't weigh a lot, but I could drink quite a bit. And I was really proud of that when I was like a teenage girl, and I could outdrink this grown man. I was proud of that. And you know, looking back on it now, that's probably one of those early warning signs that I just ignored. And so I I bounced around a lot. I didn't finish anything. Like I said, I have the four older siblings, and you know, all four of them, you know, graduated from high school and went to college and got degrees and got jobs. And you know, I did not take advantage of any of those opportunities because I was too busy chasing the next drink. And I bounced around a lot. I would, you know, I would get into relationships with people that were really unhealthy, and stay with them because I was unhealthy too. And they, you know, and if they were going to allow me to drink the way I wanted to drink, then that's what I would do. And what was interesting to me when I got sober, I will tell you this, is that when I did my first fourth step, and I did the inventories, and I'm not very good at going in a straight line. I'm just going to tell you that, so I'm going to go back and forth and back and forth. But it talks in the, it, when we do the inventory, you know, so we have the resentment inventory, and we have the fear inventory, and we have the sex inventory. So there's actually three different inventories in the book. And when I did went through the steps with my first sponsor, I only did the resentment inventory. And then a few years later, I got my current sponsor, and she's like, well, no, we got to do this fear and sex inventory too. So when I did that, that really like opened my eyes to the patterns, because I would get in a relationship with a man here who like was like the nice person that my parents would like. And you know, he had a nice bright future, and he would be treat me well and be really nice to me, but he didn't drink like me, so that was always a problem. And so then eventually I'd get bored, and so then I would go over here to the exact opposite, to somebody who was always, you know, wanting to go out and party and drink with me, and was usually pretty awful to me, and then. That would, when that would fall apart, I'd go back over here. And like, I never realized that until I did like that in all three of those inventories and looked at everything all together. And I would go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until I found the perfect mix. So I find the guy that's right in the middle. So, well, of course I married him. And, you know, so I married him, and, we have these children, so we have these two daughters. So I married him, and by this point, my drinking is getting worse, and it's getting worse, and it's getting worse. But he drank along with me. He drank pretty much at the same pace I did, so there really wasn't anybody to keep me in any kind of check. And along the way, you know, I somehow managed to eventually piece together an education, and I've got a decent job, and he's got a decent job, and you know, we buy this house, and then you know, we have these kids with, and we have the dog and the literal white picket fence, which is not all it's got cracked up to be, because you got to paint that sucker every year. But I do know that when I went in and out of a lot of different treatment places. And they would always ask, you know, like, so when do you think your drinking, you know, got out of control? Now, today I know that it was never in control, but back then I didn't know that. And I couldn't ever really pinpoint it. And in early sobriety, I think I recognized a point when I got pregnant with my oldest daughter. You know, I quit drinking. As soon as I found out I was pregnant, I quit drinking. And I went to, my sister got married while I was pregnant, and I went to her wedding. And I remember they were passing around champagne in the morning, because it was like a morning wedding, and they were doing a mimosas in the morning kind of thing. And they passed around the champagne, and I'm like, no, I can't have champagne because I'm pregnant. And they're like, oh, you can have one glass of champagne. And I didn't say it out loud, but I thought, why the hell would I want to do that? Like, why would I want to have one glass of champagne? I don't even understand that concept. But there was, and this was before I even really started questioning my drinking, but there was some little part of me in the back of my mind that was like, you can't have that one glass of champagne. And I just do, you know, some part of me knew I wasn't going to stop just with one. Why would I want to have one? So, I didn't do that. And then, when I got pregnant with my second daughter, and they're only 2 years apart, I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't. I wanted to. I really did want to. And I couldn't stop drinking. And I didn't. And I didn't sip on a glass of wine now and then. I drank pretty much almost as heavily as I ever had. And I drank a lot of the time. And when she was born, I was drunk when she was born. I went into labor. I didn't know I was in labor. And I had her at home in the living room because I didn't know I was having a baby because I was so drunk. And when I look at her today, you know, she is just a walking, talking reminder to me of God's love and grace and mercy, because she should have been born with every bit of fetal alcohol symptom and syndrome, and she should not be who she is. And somehow she's a perfectly healthy, intelligent young woman today, and that is only a result of God's grace. It's not me. Like, I could not have done that. And I try to think about every time I say to myself that I deserve something. When I start thinking, you know, I'm not getting what I think I deserve, to give thanks to that merciful God that I don't get what I deserve. So I have this baby. Now I have two little kids at home. And shortly after that, I can't even maintain that job anymore. And so I'm home, and now I'm drinking around the clock, and I went, decided I was gonna go visit my parents, and I took the kids. And I don't know why, I just put the kids in the car and decided I'm gonna drive to Pittsburgh, and I get arrested in Pennsylvania, and I get charged with the DUI and the two counts of felony child endangerment, because I'm drunk and I have the kids in the car. And I get arrested on a Friday night. And for some reason, the arresting officer took pity on me and called my parents and let my parents come and get me and get the kids, as opposed to keeping me and sending them to social services. And so that was, I'd love to say that that was it, but it wasn't. But I will say that that brought it all out into the open, and everybody in my family started like rallying the troops, like they're going to get me sober. And God bless them, they really tried. And but I didn't get sober in a straight line. Nothing happens in a straight line. And I still had to go. I went in and out of treatment a couple of times. I got a good lawyer. I got out of the DUI and the charges all on a technicality, so that all went away. So, you know, it's not really trouble if it goes away. And eventually I went into this inpatient treatment center, and I came out and I stayed sober for 3 months. And then insanity of that, just that thought. And this is where I like when it talks in the big book about the I'm just defenseless. I had not developed any kind of relationship with any kind of higher power. I was the fear would only keep me sober for a little while. And so I managed to stay sober for 3 months, and then I went on this bender, and I left home, left my husband, left the kids, and stayed gone and stayed drunk for 5 or 6 days. And then I had enough. And then that was it. And honestly, that's what happened. I'd been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a sponsor. I mean, I didn't use her as a sponsor. But I didn't have the white light. I didn't hear angels sing. But I can tell you the exact moment that I completely surrendered to all of this, to what this book tells me. I was up in that hotel room, and I prayed. I said, God, I can't do this. And I can't live like this anymore. So either take me or fix me. And I poured the rest of the booze out that I had. And I called, you know, my husband, and I called that sponsor. And, you know, I gave up. And when we talk about having a spiritual experience, when I look back, I've had lots and lots of spiritual experiences, and none of them developed into a spiritual awakening because I didn't follow them up with any kind of action. I just had that experience and thought, well, wasn't that nice? And then I kept on doing what I'd always been doing. And this time, I was willing to do what I was told to do, and I was willing to stop fighting. I always thought that I knew. I just know. That's my problem, is I just know, or I think that I know. And in early sobriety, they would say, you know, it's not what you know, it's what you think you know that just isn't so. And so I come in here, and I've got this sponsor, and I've given up, and like one of the examples that she gave to me is, and because I remember saying to her, well, okay, tell me what a spiritual action is. And she's like, well, it's any idea that isn't yours. And so, like, she would say to me, I want you to read the doctor's opinion. And so then the next day I would say, okay, well, I read the doctor's opinion and I read Bill's story. And she's like, but I told you to read the doctor's opinion. And I, but she's like, this is what I'm talking about. You have a complete inability to follow directions because I think that I know. And so I had to be taught how to do these things. I had to be taught how to come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and behave. I had to be taught how to come in and sit and be still and listen to other people when they talked. I had to learn how to live live in this world. I just didn't know. I had no ability, no tools to live in the world and to deal with life, you know, as it came to me. So I do believe that I, so I'm up in that hotel room, and that to me is kind of like my first and my second step. Like I finally conceded to my innermost self that, like, I'm an alcoholic. I understood the I understood what it is because it's in the book, and I had read the book, so now I'm reading the book. I didn't know what it was before, so I know what an alcoholic is, and I have just finally surrendered to the entire process. And so I was gifted with good sponsorship early on, and, you know, we start working through these steps, and I do not do it gracefully, I will tell you that. I fought, even though I surrendered, I still argued a lot. I still argued with a lot. And I remember she would say things to me like, and she was like, well, you can be right and I'm going to be sober. She would say that all the time. You can keep being right, I'm just going to keep being sober. So as I said, we worked the steps out of the big book. And then that sponsor that I had, she moved. And then I got this other sponsor. And she was really, really nice. And then she... And I got all the way through the fifth step with her, and then she fired me for some reason. I can't remember why. Honestly, I can't remember why. And then I got this other sponsor, and I worked with her for a few years, and then I switched over to the sponsor that I had now. So I get sober, and my kids are like 3 and 5. So I come in here, and I'm going to meet it. You know, I started going to meetings every day. And I'm working with a sponsor and trying to learn how to do all of these things that I just missed. I didn't know how to be in a relationship with people. I didn't know how to be a mother. I was so completely selfish and self-centered that I always thought of, like, I always thought of everything in how it relates to me, like I was the center of the universe. And so everything that happened, it was like, how does this affect me, or how does this make me look? And I had to learn how to shift that and look at it differently. that one of my early sponsors, you know, she would say, at the end of the day, I want you to tell me how much time you spent thinking about God and how much time you spent thinking about yourself. She's like, maybe make like one of these little pie charts. And so I'm making these little pie charts, and it was not pretty at all. It was pretty much mostly all me. And as I'm working through the steps, you know, my life, it slowly starts to change. And my perception of you and of the world and of myself just continues to change, and it continues to grow as I continue to practice these principles. And I'm just amazed at how my life has unfolded in ways that I never thought that it would. So like those two girls are all grown up now, and they've gone away to college, and they're doing all of the things that, you know, I wish that I had done. And you know, I don't know what happened that day up in that hotel room. I mean, I really don't. I heard Sandy Beach speak one time, and he talked about, you know, we hit our bottom when the next thing that we have to give up in order to keep going is something we're not willing to give up. And I could really relate to that. Like, through all the years of my drinking, I would keep giving up a little something just to keep drinking more. You know, and at first it didn't seem like much. It was just a little bit at a time. And so maybe it was, you know, maybe it's just a little bit of money, you know, and maybe I might lose a few things. And maybe I'm not friends with her anymore. And, you know, maybe my mom's mad at me. And, you know, maybe this boyfriend doesn't like me anymore. What, you know, I'll give up these little things. And, you know, that job wasn't that great. And maybe a little piece of my self-respect. And so I didn't, you know, it was just a little bit at a time. And it just happened so gradually through the years. I just keep giving this away and giving this away and giving this away and giving this away. And then, you know, I remember thinking, you know, I'm married to this guy that I thought I loved, and these kids that are great, and I have the house, and I have all of these things that are supposed to make me happy. And I'm literally sitting in this living room, drinking myself to death every day, you know, wishing I had the courage to just blow my brains out. Like, I could not figure out how that had happened to me. Like, I'm completely baffled and completely puzzled by all of this. And I still marvel at the idea that, like, I don't know why that day was different, other than it had to be just God moving in. And God can only move in, you know, if we let him. My God does not force himself on me. He does not make me do anything or see anything or be anything. And it's like, you know, when I was a little girl, I have an older brother, you know, and he would chase me around and, you know, hold you down and say, you know, I'll let you go when you give up. And I always think about that. Like, God was like, when you've had enough, you know, I will take over. But you have to have enough, and you've got to let it go. And you know, so I come in here and I work through these steps, you know, so I do these inventories, and they're awful. I mean, I hate them. I mean, I hate them. I'm miserable doing them. I don't want to write it down on paper. I still don't want to write it down on paper. Even though I know it works, I still don't want to write it down on paper. I don't want to see my part in it. I want it to be you. My ego still wants it to be you. I don't want to write it down on paper, but I did this. And when I did my fifth step with my sponsor now, like, she got out this legal pad. And I'm like, what the hell is she, excuse me, what the heck is she doing? So she's got this legal pad, and so at the end of it, she tears it off and she gives it to me. And so she makes this list of character defects, and she does these tally marks. And every time I said something, it's like, oh, there you go, there's pride, oh, there you go, there's ego, oh, there you go, it's this. And she gives me, and I still have it, and I still pull it out every once in a while and look at it. And, you know, and at the forefront of everything is that fear driven by that ego. I like to think that I know. I like to think that I know more than you. I'd like to think that if you give me enough time, I can figure it out. And, you know, I just can't do it. And I, to this day, I will still try to take control. I still wrestle with that ego. I still wrestle with thinking that I know. And, you know, I sent my sponsor this stat. Like, my husband tells me something today, and I'm, like, the words are coming out where I'm trying to tell him, and it's, like, about the gutters, like, on the house. Like, I have absolutely, like, I know nothing about gutters. I think a gutter is the thing that hangs on the side of the house. Like, that's it. That's what I know about it. But I'm prepared to tell him that he's wrong. I mean, whatever it is that he's saying, I'm prepared to tell him that he's wrong. And that's how I go. And so, you know, I do this the inventory, and I do this fifth step with the sponsor, and then and so now I've got this whole list of all of these character defects for me to start looking at in steps 6 and 7. And I will say that I believe that steps 6 and 8, we really shortchange them, and there is a reason why we have two steps that are devoted to becoming willing, because that willingness does not come naturally to this alcoholic. That's all I can say. Is I like to think, like, the idea in step 6 of, you know, come willing to have God remove these defects of character, you know, so we're in all this pain, and it's like, yeah, of course I'll let it go. Of course I want the defects of character to be gone, right? Why wouldn't I? It's not that easy. That's why it's an entire step. And what I have found through the years is that in every piece of my character defect, intertwined in there is something that I like. It serves me in some capacity. I get something out of it. And it can vary what it is, but there's something interwoven in there that I like, and I don't want to give it up. And the more I can look at that and see that, then the closer I can move to that willingness to have God remove it. But it's an ongoing process for me. I don't want to say struggle, but a process for me to look deep into that. And kind of what I'm talking about is, like, it talks about it, I think, in the 12 and 12. It's like, oh, I don't want to gossip, but then sometimes I want to make myself feel better. And so I think that's kind of one of the references it does in there. But just woven in there is that my pride and my ego, and I don't want to give certain things up. And so I have to continue to work towards that willingness. It doesn't just come because I look at that tally marks of those character defects. It's like, okay, God, here you go, take them all. And I really, the only thing I can say, when I completely surrendered, I have not ever since that moment wanted to take a drink. I'm just not one of those people that has struggled. I came in and out for a while, but once I gave up like that, I did not, and I've never wanted to have a drink. And I think that, again, is just God's way of protecting me, because there was never a time before that where, like, if I wanted a drink and I could get one, I was going to have one. Like, I was never able to, like, say, oh, I shouldn't, or no, I'm not doing, like, that just never, ever happened to me. So now I've got this list of character defects, and I'm trying to, you know, praying for the willingness to have God remove them and asking God to remove them as he sees fit for that day. And then I might have to do it again the next day and the next day and the next day for the next, I don't know, 50 years. But then, you know, I get on to, and so now I'm moving on into the 8th and the 9th steps. And again, that 8th step, like, I've got this, so I make the list of the people. Making the list in the 8th step is easy for me. It was easy to make the list. But there were people that were on the list. I'm like, I'll put them on the list, but I'm still not making amends to them. I'm just not going to. So my sponsor, you know, had me divide my list up into three separate lists. And it's like, okay, who are the people you're willing to make amends to? Let's start with them. So, you know, I have the list. And, of course, I have the ones on the list, like, I'll make amends to my mom. You know, because my mom's going to say, sorry, sweetie, you're great. You're awesome. You know, so of course I will. But, you know, am I going to make amends to, you know, my ex-husband? It's like, I don't think so. So I divided, this is not in the book. But this is how I was taught to do it. She had me divide my list up into three columns, and the ones that I was willing to make amends to, the ones that I didn't really want to make amends to, and the ones that were blank no. Nope, no way, no how, no form, ever, ever, ever. So I start working through that first list, and as I'm working through that first list, what happens is that, I'm going to meetings all the time, working with the sponsor, praying, and I'm working on developing this relationship with God. And I'm busy trying to do the footwork. And while I'm doing that, you know, God is working on my heart. And so those people on that middle list start migrating over to that first list. And the people on the I'm never going to do that, start moving over to, well, maybe one day. And, I'm grateful today that this is a process and that I don't have to figure it all out at one time. And that I have people around me to walk me through that and to love me through that. And so I'm making amends, and I'm trying to, you know, clean up my side of the street and start learning how to behave a little bit so I don't have to keep adding more and more people to the list. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting was when I make amends, one of the early ones that I made was to my oldest sister. And, you know, I went to talk to her, and I'd had an idea of the harm that I thought that I had caused her, like the things that I thought. And, I started talking about those things and feel like, you know, I'm saying, like, this is what I've done. And I'm really glad I had this experience early. And she was like, that's all great. Now I'm going to tell you what you really did. And it taught me that I think a big, for me, I believe that part of the amends is more listening and letting the other person tell me how I hurt them versus me deciding what I've done to them. And, you know, I was like, I did this and I did that. And hers was, you didn't do this. Like, you weren't there. You were gone. You know, we had Dad's 60th birthday party and you were nowhere to be found. You know, I had a baby and you weren't there. You know, you missed his birthday parties and, you know, all of those things that I wasn't available for. And that's one of the things, like, with my, I'm so grateful that my children, that got sober when my children were young, and that I was able to be, you know, that be there, be present, be available, be actually present in their lives, because I never was before that. You know, I spent my whole life looking and trying to figure out who you needed me to be, and then doing whatever I had to do to try to be that person. And I couldn't do it. Like, I couldn't figure it out, and I couldn't do it. And I was just in so much pain that I had to drink just to numb that pain. And then the booze stopped working, and I get here, and I don't have a solution anymore, and I still have all the same problems. And the truth was, I didn't have any idea who I was. You know, I had no idea who I was. I had no idea what I liked. I had no idea what I didn't like. You know, I, you know, a woman, I remember being kind of, in the first few years, you know, her asking me, like if your husband, you know, she asked me, did I want it? And I'm like, you know, I don't care. And she said, but you do care. You know, it was about trying to learn, like, who I was. That's really it, more than anything. I can't put it quite into words. But kind of like my husband will say to me, where do you want to go for dinner? And I'm like, I don't care. And then he'll say, okay, let's go here. He's like, no, I don't want to go there. And then we'll go, no, I don't want to go there either. Okay, well, clearly you care. So just pick something. But I didn't have any idea who I was. So Alcoholics Anonymous has given me this opportunity to kind of learn, like, who I am and what I like and what I don't like. Like, I used to think that I really liked bowling, and I don't at all. Bowling is not fun if you're not drunk. It really isn't, and I'm terrible at it. So I just, well, I'm sorry, it might be some fun to some people, but it's not. I didn't like bowling. But so I didn't have any idea who I was. And so, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that opportunity. And when I went in, people talk about when they come into Alcoholics Anonymous and what they think and what they thought and how they felt and all this stuff. And I don't really remember that very well because I drank a lot. Let's just say I didn't remember a whole lot. But I can tell you this. The very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I went to, Steve Showalter was there. And Steve Showalter said, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the opportunity to participate in my own life. And I remember that like it was yesterday. And I think about that all the time. And that is so true. Alcoholics Anonymous gives me the opportunity to participate in my own life. And people have said to me, when I go somewhere, like, oh, that's right, you can't drink. Yes, I can. I can drink if I want to. I just don't want to anymore. Because when I was drinking, I have a choice today. I did not have a choice when I was out there. When I was in the midst of that disease, I did not have a choice. I couldn't not drink, no matter how much I wanted to. And I desperately wanted not to drink. If you think that I did not want to stop drinking when I was 7 months pregnant and could feel that baby moving around and knowing that I was damn near killing her, I wanted to stop and I couldn't. I could not stop. And that is the most unimaginable pain that anybody outside of Alcoholics Anonymous can't quite grasp. But once I gave in and surrendered to this, that has been completely removed from me. And I don't have to drink. That's what it is. I can drink. I just don't have to do it anymore. And I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful for the life that I have today that doesn't look anything like I thought it would. When I came in, if you'd asked me what I wanted when I got here, all I wanted to do, honestly, all I wanted to do was to not drink. I didn't even care about being happy. I said, I don't want to drink anymore, and I don't want to kill those girls. That's all I wanted. I just, please don't let me kill them, because that's really what I was afraid was going to happen. And I didn't know how to be a wife. I didn't know how to be a mother. I didn't know how to be a daughter. And, you know, I learned all of that in here with you. It's funny because my youngest daughter just got home from college last night. And when I was leaving, she said, please make sure you say something funny. And I'm like, why do I need to say something funny? She's like, you know, we go to all those dinner meetings and it always seems like a little depressing. I think you should go out there and lighten it up a little bit. Say something funny. And just the gifts that this program has given me, that I didn't expect. I didn't, that first marriage didn't survive, and you know, I spent some time like on my own, and I had never done that before, and I spent a little bit of time with just me and those girls, really figuring out who I was and what I wanted out of this life, and you know, I can go anywhere and do anything and be anything I want to be today as a result of, you know, following the directions in this book. And this is about, you know, the spiritual awakening that we have is can be ongoing as long as we continue to put the work in. It's not a, you know, I have to keep working at it every day, and I have to keep being willing to, you know, admit that I'm wrong, continue to practice these principles, continue to go to meetings, continue to work with the sponsor. You know, I work with, you know, a few, I'm fortunate enough to work with a few other women. And there was a reading in the Daily Ponderables last week, and I clipped it and sent it to my sponsees because I really did love it. And it said, I love you, and because I love you, I would rather have you hate me for telling you the truth than adore me for telling you lies. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of honesty. You know, I have a sponsor who I've given a license to tell me the truth, even when I don't want to hear it and even when I don't like it. And, you know, it's saved my life. And it's, you know, I'm remarried now to a really great guy, and he is not an alcoholic. He doesn't understand alcoholism. He thinks that, you know, I maybe got on the table and danced with the lampshade on my head, and I was probably kind of cute. And I'm like, you have no idea what it was like. And it was kind of funny because when I had met him and we had become friends. And, you know, it's not like you walk in and you meet somebody and you lead with, hey, I'm a recovering alcoholic. So when I started actually, like, dating him, I'd known him for years. But he didn't know. And so we were, I'm like, well, I got to tell him. And so now it's awkward because I've known him for years. And I got to tell him. And we were on the train at Busch Gardens. And he thought that I went to church on Wednesday nights, like to go to a church service, and that was my home group meeting. And so I led with that, and I'm like, well, on Wednesdays I don't actually go to church to go to church. I go to an AA meeting because, you know, I'm an alcoholic. And he's like, oh. So he sat there for a minute, and I'm like, you know, say anything? And he's like, can I ask you a question? I said, yeah. And he's like, where do you think you want to go for lunch? And that was it. That was it. That was the end of our conversation about it. And he doesn't ask any questions. He doesn't, I don't want to say he doesn't care because that sounds unkind, but he doesn't ask any questions. There are recovering alcoholics in our house all the time. There's people coming and going, and I'm gone all the time, and he's 100% supportive, but he does not understand it. He still thinks that I was probably kind of cute. And that's okay. It's okay because he doesn't have to get it. The only person that has to get it is me. And, you know, I get it today, and I'm grateful that I have these steps. And that by working these steps, we can get Carrie Lynn out of the way, because Carrie Lynn is the problem. And when we get Carrie Lynn out of the way and we let God in and let God do the work, then that's when, you know, the real miracles start to happen. So I'm very grateful to be here. I'm very grateful to be sober today. Thank you.
Thanks, Carrie Lynn.